Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, and I am live coming to you from deep inside your large intestine. And this is stuff your doctor should know. And today, your doctor does know a lot of stuff because he is Dr. Resnick. Dr. Scott Resnick is our guest today. And he came to me from our group, from the Estrogen Dominance Support Group. He is a member. And his, his bio is so interesting, and I really want you to hear this. Dr. Scott Resnick first trained in general surgery, followed by board certification as an OBGYN, where he focused on minimally invasive surgery and the non-surgical management of pain syndromes. He has been a leader in the use of hormone management using bioidentical hormones exclusively in his practice since 2001. He completed a fellowship in anti-aging and regenerative medicine in, 2004, and has been practicing functional medicine for more than a decade. Recently, he has been working with a Canadian company developing AI to refine treatments for mood disorders using functional thinking and practices. His personal and professional mission is to democratize medicine, providing opportunities for individuals to turn around their health without drugs when their conventional doctors have failed. He believes that by using a systemic scientific approach to wellness and supporting outcomes with computer learning, we can transform medicine from a drug-focused practice to one in which true healing occurs using diet, herbs, hormones, supplementation, and mind-body practices. I think that he's speaking our language. You know, we're all about democratizing medicine and teaching everyone how to become their own first line doctor. And I just love it. I love his information. I love his mission, and I love that he reached out to me to help him in this goal that he has. We don't talk very much about that today, but I'm going to have him back, and we're going to dive deeper into that. But we do go into a lot of really awesome information here, and I hope you enjoy Dr. Scott Resnick.
I have to tell you that I'm super excited to talk to you, and I'm just I'm so impressed with kind of the the mission, the business that you've set up, the number of people that you're helping, and that's why when you gave me the opportunity to come meet with you here, that I just jumped at it because.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I'm kind of in a similar place where, I think that people are really kind of stuck, and where they're stuck between is conventional medicine. And we don't have to talk about that. We know how that's engendered, right?
Yeah.
But then on the other side, we've got natural and alternative medicine, but it's kind of like the Wild West, you know, and one thing I love about you seeing so many of your comments, which is, I think you and I share a principle. In fact, we really like going for the fundamentals, right?
And
you know, people can go off and have all their fillings taken off, but if they're, doing nothing but eating French fries and potato chips, you could have the best biologic dentist in the world working on your fillings, and it's not going to help things.
Exactly. I really like what you just said, because a lot of people use that analogy or that description where they say, you can have the best biological dentist ever and then have all your amalgams removed, and then you're eating potato chips and drinking Coke or whatever. But I feel like that's certainly an extreme, like the drinking sodas and chips. There's still other things that I used to say, okay, yeah, junk food and then healthy people. But there's all this in between, which is like people that aren't eating enough, which was my thing for so long. And other ways of being bad to yourself, like overeating. You can overeat things. You can eat too many avocados. You can eat too much fat. You can eat too much carbohydrate. And so it's like those things, the minutiae in the middle there is definitely, we're not just talking about junk food eaters. We're talking about people who are not eating well too.
Right. And I'll tell you, that sort of brings to mind a really interesting anecdote. And I had a patient when I was living in Chattanooga, Tennessee. She was like vegetarian, vegan. She'd just broken up with her boyfriend. She'd been offered a job, moved across the country from Colorado. And in a nutshell, she came to me with like skin that was just exfoliating, just like throughout her entire body. And she had thought that she was doing everything right. I'm vegetarian, vegan. I'm not eating flour. I'm not eating gluten. I'm not eating sweets. Well, as it turns out, is she had a really significant food sensitivity to almonds. So
Oh,
what,
wow.
she'd been drinking almond milk and using almond flours and eating almonds through the course of the day. And what this had done is that, in addition to a now permeable gut, probably secondary to all the stresses that she'd been incurring from, going from the love of her life, and this is the the number one, to breaking up, you're leaving your job, you're quitting, you're moving across country, doing something different. So there's a really good example where this woman was super conscientious and really smart. But even though she'd been doing, what we would say are the right things, she still managed to give herself a really significant dermatitis. And the long and the short of it was we did a variety of measuring. I mean, like her B12 was off the charts low because she wasn't supplementing, right? So you know how important B12 is for all the different processes, namely the Krebs cycle and the mitochondrial stuff that makes energy for the body. And the end of the story was that I was in the Whole Foods about 6 months after I'd seen her. And this beautiful young blonde woman just comes bounding up to me. It's like, Dr. Resnick, it's so good to see you. And I didn't recognize her. I mean, when I'd met her skin was so in such bad shape. Her face looked like she'd been in a, like a boxing match. She was so swollen and so edematous.
Wow.
And then she said, look, and she held out her arm that had been the worst of the two of them. And I instantly remembered who she was, but I wasn't able to recognize her. So, here.
Wow.
And here's an example where, what would have happened had she gone to a conventional doctor. Right.
Yeah.
She would have been put on topical steroids and creams. She might have been put on an antibiotic. She probably would have been given like some oral prednisone. And when that didn't work, what's the next step? Oh, we'll put you on a biologic, right?
Yeah,
Something
yeah.
to but just don't get tuberculosis, sick, COVID, or anything else, because now we've
Right.
totally suppressed your immune system.
Exactly. Yeah, you also just described me a little bit in the way that I was, basically I had already become a nutritionist. I was already working with people to help remediate their guts. I was working with my husband who was working with children with disabilities, and I was helping these children with their, severe candida and severe issues with, gut dysbiosis. And I was eating the body ecology diet. I was doing tons and tons of mo it was like 80-20. It was like 80%, plant-based. And then I would have like
Right.
20% of my plate would be like, animal protein or whatever. And I was really better in many ways, because when we get on any diet after eating just the regular standard diet, American standard diet, right?
So, no,
Any diet,
the SAD diet, right?
right?
Standard
The
American
SAD
diet,
diet.
right?
Right. I mean, you get on any diet. I don't care what diet it is, off of the standard American diet, you're going to see improvement,
Right.
And so,
Absolutely.
right. But it was I was definitely not doing the right things for me. It was great for a while, and it really got me out of trouble, but it also created a whole bunch of other issues. So, yeah, I mean, we have to, it's, I think that's the hard part about all of this is finding your own way, because there is no, okay, this is how everyone needs to do it. And so having the temerity, the desire, the energy to stick around and figure out what your way is. You know what I mean? Figure out what's right
Right.
for you. That's the hardest part, because a lot of these women don't have the energy to say,
Right.
okay, like play with the progesterone and oh my gosh, I'm going to get
Right.
worse. And they don't have that energy, or counting my macros. How am I supposed to count my macros in the midst of my life,
Right.
So
Right.
that's the tough part.
Right. And I would agree with you in the fact that I think that, for so many people, the stressors surrounding, like, what is the path I need to take? What guru diet, supplement, progesterone, balance? It really kind of feeds the fire for so many people. And
Yeah.
I think one of the most important things is that we need to be, I had a great professor in my training years ago who said, Scott, your patient is her own biomarker. And I really appreciate that, because what it did is it basically said that, each of us as individuals has different unique characteristics about ourselves that help to give us some insight into who we are, what we need, our diets, because as you said, not everybody is the same. I mean, how many times have you seen people who, probably have dysfunctional cortisol curves? And, I would contend that probably most people that have some degree of estrogen dominance do have some degree of dysfunctional
Yeah.
cortisol. And what they're doing is they're doing, intermittent fasting, which is the absolute, which is the right thing to do in the right context. If you want to, try to stimulate your autophagy and live longer and stuff like that. But if you're having a hard time raising your cortisol and you're doing intermittent fasting, we've got two other counter-regulatory hormones, as you know, and those are epinephrine and norepinephrine. So is it any wonder that, that a woman is thinking that she's doing, or a man for that matter, thinking they're doing the right thing by doing their IF, but yet they're frantically, barking at their kids on the way to school in the morning, and then they arrive at work and they're frantically running down the hall looking for the donuts or the cookies because they're in a hypoglycemic state and their body's just having a natural metabolic reaction to the fact you're in a prolonged period of fasting.
Yeah. And that's a tricky one as well, because you can start off with fasting and feel better, because that norepinephrine, epinephrine can, for some people, especially if you break down adrenaline well, you can feel like, I'm energized. I feel great. Damn it.
Right,
And,
right.
and then you're like, I've been fasting for 6 months. I've been fasting for a year and a half, and I feel fantastic. And it's like, meanwhile, they're really, doing a disservice to their metabolism, because they're not running off of proper energy, right? They're running off of
Right.
emergency hormones, basically, the backup generator, as we like to say.
Right. Well, so one thing which is interesting is that I'm working on a book that I'm going to entitle Cortisol is King, because I believe that cortisol is the master planner in the body. And if you think about it, it's probably the only hormone that we have that we cannot live without. Now, I was thinking about this comment earlier, and I was like, "Well, what about insulin?" It's like, "Well, insulin's a peptide, but it functions like a hormone, obviously, right?" So cortisol is, at the end of the day, we need to be thinking about ourselves in terms of what we're running on, which is really an ancestral DNA. So the human animal, assuming how long you believe we've been on this planet, we're more attuned to periods of feast and famine. More living in the wild or living in our caves and our teepees and not having a continual influx of stress and a continual influx of calories. So our entire biology is geared around keeping our brain and our heart alive. So as you know, the brain runs pretty well on ketones. It can run on fats. Its preferred food is glucose, right? So let's go back to the ancestral times when, because really, I mean, the Industrial Revolution has been what, 150 years or something like that. I mean,
Isn't that crazy?
It's not like our DNA has made a million years worth of transitions in the last 150 years. So we're effectively running on an ancestral DNA. So what does that look like? It looks like that our greatest stressor as humans is starvation, right? So when you think about, even before the agricultural era, it's like we would get up in the morning and, look for a fish, a bird, some berries, dig up some nuts, find a fruit on a tree and hopefully eat it. And what's cool is that that's reflected in our cortisol diurnal pattern as well. So if you go back to our ancestral times when we didn't have electric lights and drive through McDonald's at 2 in the morning and things like that, what happened? We probably ate our last meal cooking over a fire at, 6 or 7 o'clock at night as the sun was starting to set. We went to sleep in our caves or our teepees or our lean-tos or wherever we were. And then what happened? So it turns out that, our liver holds something like 3 hours of energy in terms of the form of glycogen. So, we're sleeping in the cave. It's 7 at night. It's 10 in the morning. We or maybe or, or I'm sorry, 10 at night or 11 o'clock at night. We've burned through those original reserves. Then what happens? We need to maintain a steady level of glucose to keep our brain alive. So what do? We go to our master planner, which is cortisol. So is it any wonder that cortisol rises up to 8 times the level in the nighttime that it is during the day? So if you do a salivary cortisol test, maybe your 3 or 4 a.m. or cortisol awakening response might be 8 times what it is, 7, 8 times what it is during the course of the day. What's happened is that we've been in a period of relative starvation for what, 7, 8, 10 hours. And so we begin to catabolize some of our tissues to be able to keep us alive. Remember, we've already burned through the glycogen that's in our liver that we stored. Where do we go? We go to our muscles to get amino acids. You know, we go to our fats to start, breaking down our fats. We go to our bones to harvest magnesium and calcium. So what's interesting is that on a diurnal day-to-day basis, looking at things from an ancestral perspective, it turns out that we're continually in a state of feast and, a feast and famine, even within a 24-hour period. And I'm convinced that's why cortisol rises up in the wee hours. It's because it's responding to a relatively prolonged period of fasting, and we're just trying to maintain a good level of glucose for our brain.
Mm-hmm. So how is it then that there are a lot of people who aren't getting up at that hour? A lot of people whose cortisol is not necessarily spiking at that time, and they're sleeping through the night. In fact, most people probably do, right?
Right. Okay. So, and I've got a really, really clear answer for that, which is really cool. So, basically there's two hormones in the body that are effectively the yin yang for managing energy, right? We've got insulin, right? So you eat a meal. This is an anabolic hormone, meaning it builds tissues, it builds bone, right? And on the flip side, we have cortisol, which is a catabolic hormone. What happens is if you go back to the work of Hans Selye, have you looked at some of his stuff?
I think not.
1926 or 1936, he was an Austrian physician, and working with rats, he discovered that in regard to a cortisol response, there are basically three stages. One's in a first state of alarm, then they get into an adaptive state where in this adaptive state that they're maintaining high levels of cortisol, and then they would kind of go into an exhaustive state. That could be artificially categorized as a stage 1, 2, and 3 adrenal fatigue. So here's what's interesting. Is in sort of like the state of exhaustion or the state of collapse. But this is the point where you start to see the cortisol levels and the DHEAS levels go down over a period of time. So when you see someone who's got a 4-part salivary cortisol test, the very first thing that I would look at was their DHEAS levels. And this goes down as we age, but relative to the cortisol levels.
So just for the levels, listeners.
So the interesting thing about DHEAS, which I specified, is this is purely an adrenal hormone. But anyway, so you've got these two hormones, which are kind of like doppelgangers. I mean, you've got insulin, which after we've eaten is secreted to activate allow the glucose to go into the cells through the GLUT receptor, the glucose insulin receptor. That's building tissue. So conversely, you've got cortisol, which takes those reserves and breaks it down into glucose to keep the brain alive. So what's interesting is that when you look at biochemistry, the cortisol is known as the counter-regulatory hormone. Okay, and this is, Kitty, bear with me. This is all going to make sense in just a second. Okay, cortisol is our counter-regulatory hormone. Insulin is the regulatory hormone, right? So what happens is that we have two other counter-regulatory emergency hormones, and those are epinephrine and norepinephrine. So let's go back to that Hans Selye, more advanced stages of adrenal fatigue. And I'll put this in air quotes because the adrenals really don't fatigue. But this is someone who has low cortisol over the course of the day and low DHEAS as well. So what happens? They have their meal at 7 o'clock at night. They go to sleep. Their body burns through their glycogen in their liver. But what happens at 2 or 3 in the morning? If they're not able to mount a high cortisol response with our number one preferred counter-regulatory hormone, cortisol, what do they've got? They've got the catecholamines, which are epinephrine and norepinephrine. Mm-hmm. So typically the people that are waking up, and when people wake up in the morning, it's like they're like bolt out of bed, right? I'm sure they tell you that it's like they go from sleeping to like, oh, I'm just wide awake. I'm going to start ironing or cleaning the house or, writing my novel or something. What that is because I believe that we've lost that ability to raise our cortisol in a physiological state. Our brain and our hypothalamus is still asking for glucose in the middle of the night. So what do we have? We've got the twin troublemakers, epinephrine and norepinephrine. And cortisol secretion, as you know, if you look at any salivary cortisol test, is a nice gradual up and it's a nice gradual down, right? It's released in a very patient way. But the thing is, adrenaline is like, it hits you like a freight train. And so my belief is that a lot of the people who are waking at 3 or 4 in the morning have a general, I'm not surprised to see a low morning cortisol awakening response cortisol level, because what I think is happening is that if they're not able to mount that cortisol response because their adrenals have been suppressed centrally from their pituitary and their hypothalamus, they respond with like what I call the twin troublemakers, epinephrine and norepinephrine, which, raise the blood sugar just fine, but they've got all those secondary effects as well of anxiety and nervousness and, you know, rapid heart rate and all that other stuff. And I think that's what wakes people up.
Yeah. Interesting. And so just having like a late night right before bed, you know, snack is could be the answer, right?
Right. Yep. That's so observant. And I've had, you know, so many of my patients over the years who have an overall hypocortisolism, like a suppressed cortisol secretion pattern over the course of the day. You know, they're in that Hans Selye stage three, so to speak, state of exhaustion. You know, they've just been pushing on that stress button for so long. And I can't tell you how many people have changed their lives by at, you know, 11 o'clock at night, they have some kind of a food, which I typically recommend something which is a little higher in protein or a little higher in fat. So maybe it's, you know, maybe it's nuts, maybe it's a bowl of yogurt with some berries. Again, that all comes back to what are your personal food preferences? You
right.
know, do you tolerate dairy? Do you, you know, do you eat milk products, that kind of stuff. But I think we can all find some, you know, some late in the evening, you know, high protein, high fat, food, you know, maybe it's, edamame and soybeans and, you know, eat a half a cup of that at 11 o'clock at night. And I can't tell you how many, primarily women, cause I'm a gynecologist by training, right. Have told me that, that simple intervention changed things and helped them to sleep.
So that's
what I believe is the physiology behind it. And, you know, that's really supported by having looked at thousands and thousands of these four-part salivary cortisol tests, which I think is really a foundational step to understanding what's driving your physiology. Because one thing which is really interesting is this. So let's take this metaphor a little farther, because this is something I just love to talk about. And I love the fact that you and I don't have any kind of an agenda here. You know, we're just sort of rapping, right?
Absolutely.
So what I like to do is, you know, I sort of stratify our body's physiology into different strata, right? And on the foundation, I like to say we need to be thinking about nutrition. And that's different from diet, you know, so that means we need our essential amino acids. We need the right type of fats in the right quantities. We need our cofactors, our minerals, our phytonutrients and stuff like that. Once we've established that, almost in a Maslow's pyramid type way, we can then go up to the next level, which is what I like to refer to as the energetic level. This is going to make so much sense to you in just a second. So check it out. There's three hormones that are associated with managing our body's energy, right? There's cortisol, which is, you know, it's like our emergency hormone for the reasons we just discussed. I mean, if your tribe is migrating, you're, you know, escaping a conflict, your castle is under siege and you're not eating, what happens? Your cortisol levels are high. You start catabolizing and breaking down the tissues that you've stored on your body. So whether it's your, you know, your muscles, your organs, your bones, your fat, cortisol breaks that stuff down. Of this triad of energetic hormones, the other is insulin. And like I said, insulin and cortisol are kind of like yin yang relative to one another. But the cool thing is that the third hormone in this triad is thyroid. Okay. So thyroid is kind of like our body's thermostat. Okay. So let's go back to the, you know, husband, wife, caveman couple who are in their cave, the tribe didn't kill an elk that the previous fall, the nuts that they'd stored under the rocks were stolen by a squirrel. The groundhog didn't see a shadow. It's going to be a long winter, right? So what happens? Clearly let's talk about the woman, the cave woman. Okay. In this context, the cave woman is not making insulin. I mean, she's not eating, right? So she's in a pure state where her body is secreting cortisol to break down, to catabolize her tissues, to keep her alive. Okay. So if you are God or Mother Nature, and you knew that occasion that your precious animals would potentially be starving in a cave for an extra month until the berries and the bunnies and the fruits and the fish came back, you'd probably want them to be able to almost go into a state of hibernation. So this is where thyroid comes in, okay? Because it would make sense that if you've got a finite amount of energy that you've got packed onto your bones, right? If you could lower your metabolism, that might keep you alive for another day or week or 2 weeks or something like that until you were able to start eating again, okay? So I'm gonna follow this through with you because it's so interesting. So we know that reverse T3, right, is increased by periods of infection, inflammation, and starvation. All right. So isn't that interesting? So here's your precious animal hoping to survive another couple of weeks until the ground thaws and you're able to go out, you know, hunting and find some food again. It would make sense that your hypothalamus would put you into a relatively hypothyroid state, because in the big picture of survival, nice cuticles, luscious hair, nice eyelashes, and a thunderous libido are not what we're talking about. Because remember, we're working on ancestral hormones. We're trying to just purely to stay alive. So what happens is that we know that when women are under significant periods of stress, and this research has been done for 40 years, looking initially at runners who ran 6 to 7 miles a day, we know that those women begin to not ovulate as effectively, right? Even going into a state of anovulation, all right? But in the progression of not ovulating well, what happens? I mean, the primary hormone of ovulation is progesterone, right? So what's interesting is that, I mean, if you follow this out to the very end, I mean, if you're God and you've got a, precious animal who's trying to survive in a cave, do you want her to lose 80 cc's of blood on a monthly basis when she's trying to stay alive? That's warming. It's however many milligrams of iron. Of course not. So it makes sense that a woman who's under a lot of stress gets into a relative, moves towards a state of anovulation. Okay. But the progression to a state of anovulation is typically moving through subsequent stages of low progesterone. And that's where it's just like everything should just go, aha, that makes sense. So why is it that so many of the 43, 45-year-old women who follow you on your site are, maybe they're doing their Pilates and the yoga every day. They're IFing. They're stressing because they're still bringing their kids to school and, racing around and what have you. They've pushed their cortisol to a state where they're almost in an overall hypocortisol, low cortisol state over the course of the day. Over that time period, they've begun to ovulate less efficiently, which means that they're now in a state of estrogen dominance. And then factor in a woman who's maybe in her late 40s, pushing 50, menopause, that almost makes things even worse. So what I think is really important, and what's so cool is in reading so many of your posts and blogs and comments and stuff like that, you and I are speaking the same language here, because we recognize that there are these three hormones that need to work collectively, and they're insulin and they are cortisol and they're thyroid. And I think we are remiss with our patients, and even as individuals, as we work to figure out our own path to get healthy, to not be thinking about these collectively. Because in terms of how a human's biology is designed, these necessarily need to be seen together. And now it makes sense. It's like, wow, the woman who's been under a lot of stress, she's IFing, she's not eating for 18 hours a day, her cortisol is dysfunctional. Is it any wonder that her TSH is 4, or it's 4.5, or it's 5? And the way I see it is it's just really it's a way for us to try to reconcile our ancestral DNA with modern stresses.
I
Now,
love it.
when everything goes to hell in a handbasket is when you factor in high cortisol, high stress, and gratuitous calories, right? Okay, so think about it. Remember, I told you that cortisol and insulin are doppelgangers. They're yin yang. You can't have both high cortisol and high insulin in nature, but you can have high cortisol and high insulin in the year 2022 when you're stressed out all day long. So what happens is people are eating high carbohydrate food meals, right? Their pancreas is starting to crank out more and more insulin. But what's happening? The cortisol we know works at the insulin receptor to inhibit the binding of insulin and glucose to the insulin receptor. I mean, it makes sense. If cortisol and insulin are sort of mortal enemies, they would both have a way to influence one another. So we know that cortisol works at the insulin receptor. So now you can see how someone gets into a really pernicious downward spiral, because they're in a high cortisol state, right? They're breaking down their muscles and their tissues, yet they're creating an environment at the cellular level to include the brain, mind you, where their insulin isn't able to work. So what happens is you've got high levels of insulin floating around in your bloodstream, even though you might have a normal fasting blood sugar and a normal hemoglobin A1C. And I'm going to say that one more time, is that, the typical paradigm in modern medicine is to check your fasting blood sugar. Oh, it's 90. That's fine. Maybe get your A1C. Oh, it's 5.3. That's a little high, kitty, but you're all right. What's your fasting insulin? I mean, I've seen women who have just those quote, normal lab values. But when you look at their fasting insulin, it's 17 or 20, it's like super high. Optimal is probably 4 or 5, or ideally, 3, right? So what's interesting is we get into this vicious cycle of high cortisol, high insulin, dysfunctional insulin receptors, So now what happens to all that glucose that's floating around in our bloodstream? It can't be taken up into the glycogen to be converted or delivered to be converted into glycogen. It's not converted into the muscle. It's not taken up into the muscles to be converted into glycogen and stored. Where does it go? It goes into our fat cells. Now remember, the fat cells are able to take in sugar in the form of free fatty acids without using the GLUT receptor, which insulin works on. So you can see how people get into kind of like this vicious, what did I say, pernicious cycle of high cortisol, which breaks down your muscles and your tissues. It weakens your gut. It actually shrinks your brain. You know, there's good studies that show that high cortisol levels cause a measurable shrinkage in the hippocampus, which we can measure on an MRI scan. And these studies have been done in humans. Okay,
It makes
it
sense.
causes. It makes your insulin receptor not work so well. So what happens? All the glucose that you're consuming doesn't get converted into glycogen in your liver and your muscles. It gets converted into free fatty acids, and that gets taken up into fat cells. So how many times have you talked to, you know, one of the people you work with who says, "I don't get it. I'm fasting, I'm doing IF, I'm not eating a lot of calories, and I'm just putting on weight, and I'm putting it around my middle." Well, that's that centripetal deposition of fat that we see when someone's cortisol is high. And then adding insult to injury is the fact that their insulin receptor through the GLUT1 transporter is not working well. That extra glucose gets converted into free fatty acids. Free fatty acids are then taken up into our fat cells, all right? But wait, there's more, because as we know, the fat cells are little cytokine producers, right? So what do they make? They make inflammatory cytokines. And what else do they make? They make estrogen, right? So, you know, so from this little scenario that we just discussed, you can see how it's kind of a vicious cycle that taps into a lot of our different modalities of the way that our body's intended to work. Because our body was intended to survive in times of feast and famine, not times of unending food with artificial stressors. You know, like a real stress is your tribe is going for 2 months without eating. A real stress is the once in 10 years when you really get chased by a saber-toothed tiger. But how many people in our modern world are subjecting themselves to, you know, Instagram stressors, cell phone batteries, traffic jams, crappy bosses, bad relationships? You know, there's so many other things that are artificially keeping our cortisol up.
Let's go back to the cave woman and let's talk about also, just because now she might be a little estrogen dominant because her progesterone levels crash because of her scenario, she then doesn't have the external exposure of xenoestrogens and fake estrogens in her food and fake estrogens in chemicals in the environment. And so I think that adds another layer of hormonal disruption to our modern woman, as opposed to the cave woman, where, modern women now are getting fibroids and masses. We don't know if women were getting them then, but my guess is they weren't. And they also weren't, upwards of 250 pounds either, and 5 foot four, and that just wasn't happening. They were smaller people anyway, but it was just a different time. And all of that was amazing what you said. And I was just thinking the ancestral hormone concept, because I was reading on, I forget what I was reading. They were saying that vitamin D, hormone D, is the oldest hormone known to us. And also then, and that maybe progesterone was born of it, was born from vitamin D, because they operate in such similar ways. I will try to find that, but what do you think about that?
You know, it's interesting because as you were saying that, I was trying to reach deep into the recesses of my memory to try to remember what the cyclic ring structure is of vitamin D. And almost, I wish I could, you know, access my computer right now and just see how similar the two of those hormones are. But, you know, vitamin D, if I'm not mistaken, is a cholesterol-based hormone. And I love how you didn't refer to it as a vitamin, but as a hormone. Because really, because vitamin D, I mean, functions like a vitamin, like a hormone, excuse me. I mean, we've got, you know, it's translocated into the nucleus of a cell. There are actually VDR, vitamin D binding regions, that are responsible for the vitamin D, you know, actually lodging onto the DNA and then helping to tell your DNA promoters, you know, your mRNA to, you know, what is intended to be read off of the DNA. So that's a very interesting concept, because another thing is that, you can bet that, 100,000 years ago, or 50,000 years ago, or 10,000 years ago, that we were spending more time in the sun, right? And we probably had had more adequate levels of the vitamin D. Let's do this. Let's. I'm not. That's actually a really interesting thought. Okay, when we're done,
It's
I'm going
in
to go.
here. Yeah, here is this progesterone, esterol, has generally been regarded as the oldest hormone with an age of 500 million years usually given. But with the discovery of progesterone molecules in the walnut tree in 2010, the date of origin has been pushed back.
Wow.
Yeah,
Wow.
but then it has a comparison, or possibly as old as progesterone is another sterol, vitamin D3 cholecalciferol. Although initially a vitamin, it is converted by the liver, of course, to 25-OHD3 calcidiol. Then this is converted by the kidneys and other tissues. Where did it say? Both progesterone and vitamin D are manufactured from another sterile cholesterol. Progesterone is the brain, glial cells, adrenals, ovaries, and testes, where vitamin D3 is made by the action of UVB sunlight as it strikes the cholesterol covering our bare skin. But then it goes on to say, and I don't want to just read this whole thing, but it talks about how similar they are and how maybe it actually was born from vitamin D.
Right.
So
I think that's
interesting.
really fat. Yeah, that's really super interesting. And thanks for bringing that up. And I can tell you, when at some point in the near future, I'm going to dive into that rabbit hole and try to learn a little more. So let's do this. Let's take this even a step farther. Okay. While we're kind of on this discussion. So I told you that when I work with patients, I've kind of devised almost like a Maslow's hierarchy of systems that
Pyramid.
starts with nutrition, right? The next level is ensuring that we balance our what I refer to as kind of like the energetics triad, right? Which is insulin, cortisol, and thyroid. The next layer above that is what I would refer to as our ability to maintain our barriers, right? Because for all those 500 million years, or however long humans have been on this earth, we have been exposed to microbial species that want to get into the components that we have. They want our water and our amino acids and our fats and our glucose and things like that. So what we've done is we have needed to develop some semi-permeable barriers. Okay, so what are these barriers? Our biggest barrier, our largest organ, is our skin, right? The other a barrier, which is so near and dear to your heart and mine as well, as our gut, right? And then we also have some other barriers as well, like the epithelial barrier layer that lines our lungs. And what's neat is, if you start to think about how the human's health really depends on maintenance of good barriers. I mean, who was it? Robert Frost said, what was it? It was good fences make good neighbors, right? Remember that from the poem "Mending Wall." Is there was some research that came out in the last couple of years out of Harvard, actually showing that there are antigen presenting cells under our basically the layer levels of our layers of our blood levels, and that we know about the brain blood barrier as well. So much of the human physiology is really directed around maintaining these barriers. Okay, so let's go back to our cave woman, or let's go back to our modern day woman, okay, who's been struggling with a high level of cortisol, right? We know that cortisol, and this is interesting because I was in general surgical training in like the early 90s, so it would have been 91 when I started. And the general surgeons made some really interesting observations. And that is that when people get into like shock states generated by high cortisol and high epinephrine and norepinephrine, so adrenaline, right, is that the body was shunting blood away from the gut. And actually, the general surgeons in the early 90s recognized that following a state of shock, the people were releasing LPS, or lipopolysaccharide, into their bloodstream. But the surgeons kind of stopped for a moment and said, "Let's think about this. We just had this, like a drunk who fell asleep on the railroad track, right? The train ran over both of his legs. No trauma to the gut at all, but he's still releasing LPS into his bloodstream. Why is that?" It's because high cortisol, which of course is being released to try to cause some vasoconstriction, to increase the heart rate, to keep this guy alive, is diverting blood away from the gut. But wait a minute. The gut is a single layer of mucosal cells held together by these tight junctions, right? 70% of our immune system cells, these dendritic cells, are located within 1 centimeter of the lining of the gut. And these cells that line the gut have to regenerate every 3 days. So what happens if somebody is in a, let's go back to the pyramid, a nutritionally deficient state on the, mm-hmm. on the bottom, they're missing the essential amino acids to be able to, you know, regenerate the cellular lining. They're in a state of hypothyroidism and high cortisol, and that cortisol is diverting blood away from the gut. A gut that has blood diverted from it is more likely to become porous and more likely to become leaky. So you can start to see how now, you know, this constellation of stress, poor diet, you know, low fiber, hypothyroidism, high cortisol is now allowing the gut to break down. And the gut is probably our principal barrier to the outside world. You know, we consume something like 2,000 pounds of food a year. But, you know, no matter how many times you wash your lettuce or your carrots or something like that, you're still going to be ingesting some microbes. You know, we can't avoid that. And there are, what is it, something like 100 billion, you know, microbes that, you know, bacteria that live in our colon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these species are on and within our body as well. So you can see as somebody starts to develop a, you know, like cortisol dysfunction, hypothyroidism, right? Mm-hmm. And inflammation, that then we start to break down our most principal barrier to the outside world, which is our gut. But yeah. We also start to break down our skin as well. I mean, how many people who've you spoken to who are hypothyroid complain about, you know, dry, cracking skin or mm-hmm. or less healthy cuticles or you know, not having hair that feels like the way that it's supposed to. It's because our body starts to jettison these things in order to keep us alive. Yeah. And I think that the picture I just tried to paint is one of the main reason that autoimmunity is becoming so, you know, so prevalent, in the world. I mean, I think that 1 in 12 Americans has an autoimmune condition.
Wow. I'm sure that's going to go up. I thought it might've been a little bit higher just because of, maybe because everyone that we work with, you know, is like, it's more like 1 in 5, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Kiran Krishnan mentioned, the microbiologist mentioned, that cortisol cycle ends in the gut and that also creates this, it creates leaky gut, and that there's a bacteria, I think it's called Bifidus longum, I think, or something. And it's, okay. And we're deficient in that, or we're extinct in that. And that particular microbe, that bacteria that helps to complete the cycle and heal and not let the cortisol break down the tissue, the lining of the gut. And so that's the function of that bacteria is. And so you can take that bacteria and buy it, of course, in a supplement, and it helps to, you know, keep the cortisol from degrading the gut lining. So there's that, I guess, right? So there's that, right. And then the adrenaline, and then
right. And while we're on this topic, you know, we talked about the enterohepatic, you know, recirculation of the estrogens, right?
Mm, yeah.
The fact that the estrogens are primarily supposed to be, you know, after they go through their phase 1, phase 2, hydroxylation, you know, whether they're, you know, they're methylated or sulfated or glutathionated, you know, they're supposed to be sent out through the gut. But the thing is that, as you know, there's a significant amount of this enterohepatic recirculation, whereby if a woman tends towards constipation because she's not consuming enough fiber, you know, if her detox pathways aren't running as smoothly as they could because of either genetics or the lack of having the right type of phytonutrients that actually help to, you know, support these liver mediated pathways, mm-hmm. that she could not only be recirculating her estrogen and damaging the lining of her gut, you know, through the cortisol, she could also be not able to fully metabolize out her estradiol as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's such a common thing that we're seeing now more than ever. And I'm right in the perfect place for studying this at the moment, because I'm about to do Georgie Dinkoff's hair and nail steroid analysis. It's supposed to be, besides prolactin, it's supposed to be a really great way to figure out the levels of tissue estrogen. And we're trying to prove that in menopause, the estrogen isn't declining. It's just declining in circulation. And it's actually because it is an opposed by progesterone, it's going into the tissues. And that is, that's a problem, especially, of course, for all the reasons you just mentioned, because of thyroid, you get into menopause. Okay, let's back up again to the cavewoman. So I really liked what you said. In fact, I love it. And I hope that's in your book, because it's a different perspective on aging. Because, when women start to lose their period, or they start to lose their hair, or whatever, all these things happen. And the body's like, okay, I don't have time for nails and libido and beautiful hair and lashes, or even a normal period. So your perspective is a survival perspective. A lot of us women are being taught and have this program in our heads from doctors, from everything, saying, you're done. Your body's done. You're shutting down because there's no use for you anymore. You're at this aging point. If you can't make babies, you really physically, you might have some skills and you might have a great job, but your body's like, I'm done, And then you get that in your head. And I like your perspective better, which is, no, your body is trying to survive and it's trying to keep you alive. And it's prioritizing things, and it is reversible. Not aging isn't reversible, but aging gracefully, aging, falling apart is reversible. So I really liked what you said. And so that brings me to now, which is about detoxing estrogens and about menopause, and that maybe we're onto something in regards to finding better ways for women to not only perceive what they're going through as far as perimenopause and menopause goes, but also to manage it in better ways. So we're not just trying to throw hormones at it. I mean, I love progesterone, but I also know that it's stopgap, that we need to upregulate the things that are slowing down, like the thyroid and whatnot. And I went off in the weeds there, but
I do. I just want to reframe a couple things real quick. So first of all, it's really unfortunate that we are still being influenced by this somewhat grossly inaccurate and somewhat misogynistic view that, once a woman turns 51 and stops having her period, it's kind of, it's out to the glue factory, right? because if you think about it, if you think that our youth, and let's characterize this by, say, the development of our brains, right? We know continues until maybe our early 20s, all right? So if you go through menopause when you're 50, average age is 51.4 or something like that in the US, but let's call it 50. So there's 30 years, premenopausal. We know that, I would say the average lifespan of women is probably up into their 80s. So realistically, we could say, wow, by the time you go through menopause, you've really only lived half of your life. Right. And yes, we do need to say goodbye to the fact that those were the reproductive years. Right. I think going back to sort of like our ancestral humans, my guess is that most people didn't live past 50 because we didn't have we didn't have the hygiene. We didn't have the sterilization of, didn't have refrigerators. We didn't have antibiotics. Dentists. We didn't have dentists. We didn't have all these things. So, but what's interesting is that when we look at our telomeres, right, and we, project out what healthy aging looks like in terms of telomere shortening, we should realistically be able to live, past 100. And we see that in the blue zones, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that let's you and I from here forward say, no longer will we say that, I've never said this, but, do we condone this idea that a woman who's menopausal is done? Because I think that, there's so many things that women and men, can do from age 50 on. And I think there's this concept of generativity, like how can you share what you've learned, what your understanding of, life sciences or business or parenting or teaching or whatever it is that you do. There's so much value in humans as we age. Mm-hmm. And I do think that, menopause is a difficult transitional time. But I think a lot of it does come down to so many of these other things. I mean, sadly, the cultural trope is that, this woman's struggling with menopause because her estrogen is not high enough. Let's put her on some esterase, right? Or even worse, let's put her on some Premarin, right? However, you and I know that Yes, there are a small percent, and this is a place where you and I have faced off in the past, but there are a small percentage of women who whose lives are absolutely miserable when they go through menopause. I mean, the hot flashes, the night sweats, the mood changes are incapacitating. And I'm of the belief that when, with the combination of a select, patient group and education and understanding risks and benefits, and I think, that might be a someone who might benefit with hormone replacement therapy.
No, I
But I
agree
don't think
with
it's,
that. I definitely
but it's
agree with that.
but it's not something that we just necessarily reach to, like, oh, you're through menopause, so you need this. Because if
Yeah.
a woman is thinking well and her, she's not struggling with, vaginal lubrication, with her partner, and even that can be dealt with without using hormones, of course. There's no like knee-jerk response that says you need to be on Prempro, unless of course you're part of the pharmaceutical industry, and that's a whole,
Yeah. Yeah.
that's a whole different
Well,
study.
I've had several doctors on recently and just talking about this. And, the reason for my really sort of firm stance in the group is because I don't want to be a part of the group where people are perceiving me as saying, I told them to get on estrogen. Kitty's group said, get on estrogen. I would rather come from a perspective of, if you're going to do that, make sure you have a doctor. I don't want to be the person to tell you to do that. Even if it's helping you, I don't want to be the person to say yes, because I just know too much, right, about the potential for people doing that because they just give up. Like if if I get a person, I've been reading Dutch tests now for 5 years and I look at it no longer 6 or 7 years. I look at a Dutch test and I see somebody who's favoring a 16-OH and 4-OH pathway. And they have gut issues and their cortisol is out of control and they have no libido and vaginal dryness or painful sex and they want to get on estrogen or they're on estrogen. I'm just like, I don't want to have anything to do with that. If you're asking me, I'm going to say no. And I don't even want to have the conversation in the group because that to me is a cancer waiting to happen. And so I don't want to be that. If I was a doctor, I might be more inclined to visit that and entertain that conversation. But I do have clients on estrogen. I do have client. I didn't put them on it. I just said, hey, if you're it's going to make you feel better, I think you should do what you need to do because I've seen their Dutch, I've seen their bloods, and I'm like, you know what? Do let your doctor do their thing. I don't want to stop you from that. So that's why everyone perceives me as this like a hard ass about this, but because I know that I don't want to be the person that says I got cancer because Kitty told me that I should be on estrogen. And let me tell you, stuff happens in that group and you've seen it where I do feel responsible. And I didn't even have anything to do with the conversation. And they're like, well, the estrogen dominance group says, I'm like, no. So I have to be extra careful when it comes to estrogen and iron. So, but going to, yeah, so I've had a bunch of doctors on recently and like yourself who are awesome and who are functional doctors now. And they talk about estrogen and they all say the same thing. They say, and under the guidance of someone like yourself, I mean, of course I'm going to feel comfortable about that. But I do think that that's the most important part is the gut, is the gut.
I'd even go one step lower, and I would say that the most important thing is to, I'm a huge believer in individual autonomy, and our ability as individuals to make the best decisions for ourselves. And I think that in order to make good decisions, you have to have good information that's presented to you. And if the only recourse that you have to give you information about your hormone replacement therapy is a doctor saying, "Sweetheart, I'm going to put you on Prempro, and trust me, this is what's good for you, because there's lots of research on it. And by the way, there's a prescription pad that was given to me by the drug rep that's sitting on my desk, so it's super easy for me just to
And
prescribe."
I'm writing with the pen that's
Right,
from
writing with the pen while my staff is enjoying the Prempro free lunch in the back room. So I'll tell you this, like, so when I was in Taos, this will interest you, we had a moratorium against any drug reps bringing food. into our practice, because we really wanted to kind of say, look, our clinical decision making is based on the literature, based on our clinical experience, and we don't want to have our thinking clouded at all by somebody coming and effectively bribing us with, tickets to the golf club. And that was, the heyday, 40 years ago was like, flying doctors to junkets, to golf weekends and stuff,
Are
just
they
so they
still
can.
allowed to have, are they still allowed to give like weekend CEU seminars? Or can you still get your continuing education credits from pharma companies?
You can, but there's a lot, there are a lot more stringent regulations on how they
Well,
do it.
that's good to know.
Right. But I do think that the drug companies still continue to sponsor a lot of the continuing education. And I read recently that, that something like 60% of the, medical schools are being funded in large part by the drug companies.
Wow.
So,
Well,
that's a no
I'm not
surprise,
even
right?
upset. Yeah, I'm not even, I wouldn't expect any less or any more, I should say, from them. I wouldn't
Right.
expect any more.
So the bottom line, and what I love about the fact of what you and I are trying to do is to create good healthcare consumers. Is give people good science, give them a good understanding of the steps that they can take to really make the best decisions, for an individual.
Yeah.
And I think that's the most important thing that I learned early on in my medical career is that I'm a I mean, what does doctor come from? Its Latin root is doctare, to teach. Right. That, doctare doesn't mean prescribe. So I think that's really been, one of the most important things for us to be able to do is to be able to meet with someone and say, these are your different options. Each of these has potential risks and potential benefits. I mean, I know that you're not a big fan of, postmenopausal estrogen, but if a 53-year-old woman has a, bone density study with a, a T score of -4, wow, her risk of falling down and breaking her hip in the next, 5 years is probably 10 times that of potentially maybe developing a breast cancer or uterine cancer from estrogen. So I think that, we need to be looking at these things on an individual basis. And I just love the fact that we're just out there saying, hey, here's the science. Here's what we understand to be good testing. Here's what we understand to be good counsel. And hopefully this will help you to make good decisions.
When I first started practicing practicing nutrition with my husband, I had clients that would come to me and say, I want to get off my diabetes medication, my high blood pressure medication, and my statins. I want to get off of them. How do I do that? And I would say, well, here's what you have in store. Here's what you have to do. We've got to remediate your kitchen. We have to do this. We have to do this. Well, here's a list of foods to include and exclude. Here's a list of supplements that you need to take. Here is the type of lifestyle you need to start to develop, the type of exercise that would be right for you. Here are the things you need to do if you want to get off those medications. And they're like, I can't do this. I can't do that. And they would say, I can't do it. And I would say, then don't get off your medications. I'm not like to hell with medications, to hell with estrogen. No, please don't do that. Please don't fall down and break your hip. But are you willing to do a pro-metabolic diet and increase your help to boost your thyroid and get it back online? Are you willing to do some liver detoxification? Are you willing to, do the thing? Are you willing to eat carrot salad every day for 3 months? Are you willing to? And people aren't. I can tell you right now, and you probably know this better than me, most people either don't want to, or they can't do all of the things that it takes to do those things. And I have respect for that. I support those people. I want to help those people also. But that's not my passion. My passion is to do what I've done for myself and for other people, which is to, oh, look, I'm 53. I'm in menopause, I think officially. I know what all those things are like, all the problems that women have. And I'm managing, and I am symptom free at the moment with nothing but progesterone. Of course, all the homework, but no estrogen. So I and but that's me, and I can't expect everybody to be me, but I know it can be done. So I know that the source of that issue is not just low estrogen. I know there are other things being overlooked. And again, I'm not basing this off of my own anecdotal lifestyle experience. Of course, there's other, you know, I'm being guided by research by Georgi Dinkoff and other information that I've seen that's like, wow, I think we're being led down the wrong road here. Especially right. with the Alzheimer's study and all this, it's like, so I am there for the long haul and for the people who are also there for the long haul and for everyone else. I'm also here to help you. I know how to, I sell estrogen. I don't know if anybody knows that. I work for Own as Natural. I sell estradiol and estriol. It would be in my best interest to start pimping that stuff out.
Right.
But it's not what I'm here for. You know what I mean? I'm sure my partner would prefer that I kept my mouth shut. But, right. You know.
And I think, you know, one thing that we can do, which I think is so important is, you know, I've always said, you know, never trust a functional medicine doctor who's got a, you know, wadded up McDonald's bag, you know, tossed into his or her trash can. And I think that, you know, what we can do is we can, you know, we can model lifestyle and behaviors, you know, for our patients. And I think that's a really important thing. I mean, you know, I can tell you that, I mean, I'm turning 61 this summer. I mean, I still wear the same clothes. I could fit into something I would, you know, wore when I was in high school. I mean, I'm a rock climber, mountain biker, you know. Amazing. it's, you know, because I believe that when we attend it, but what's the trade-off? The trade-off is I take some time every night to prepare some beautiful meals, and it takes more of my time and energy to do it. I'm very conscientious about the steps that I need to take to mitigate my stress response, because I have a tendency or a predilection to be, you know, my ex-wife told me that I was addicted to thinking, you know.
That's a nice way of saying it.
Yeah, right. Which I think that's kind of like some kind of speak for, you know, ADD or something like that. But
yeah.
But I recognize she's right, and what I find is that you know, I need to make concessions for all these things. You know, I love coffee. You know, but I get up and I have my one cup of coffee before 8 o'clock in the morning. Because if I get lazy and I have a cup even of decaf in the early afternoon, I'm awake at 1 a.m, you know, wondering why I did that. So
yeah.
I think it's really important, as you and I both do, to try to model these things and provide information to help people to make their, you know, their own best decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, the bottom line is that everybody's trying. You know, one of the most important things that I found that I could give to my patients was compassion and understanding and saying, look, I know you're trying to do this. I know that, you know, there's not a Whole Foods in your neighborhood and you can't get organic food. I know that your husband is a meat and potatoes guy and that's all he eats. So if you bring home tofu, it's not going to be eaten. I mean, you know, we're all doing our best to, you know, to try to do these things, but you're right. It's a lot of work. I mean, to make your carrot salad, to go to the store, to shop for the organic carrots, to eat carrots
every day. Who wants to do that? I don't, but hey, I mean, we take our statins every day and we take our, you know, diabetes meds every day and we can do it. If a doctor prescribed it to you, you'd probably do it every day. If doctor right. was like, hey, hi, I'm Dr. Resnick. And I think that you here, I'm going to write this on my prescription pad. You right. need to have carrot salad every day, or else you're going to endotoxin poisoning and you're going to have real big issues with your gut. They would do it. But Kitty right. Martone says it and they're like, do I have to shred the carrot? Can I just eat the carrot? it's the funniest conversation in the group.
I just had a funny thought come to my mind. I just sort of envisioned kind of like the pre-printed prescription pad, you know, on your desk that's not given to you by Big Pharma, but given to you by your local organic grower.
Farmers, that says, yeah, your farmer.
It says, you know, take two carrots, you know, Q-day, for health.
Yeah, shredded with vinegar. You know, I had this genetic testing done and I had this pharmaceutical, I forget what he is, Dr. Tyler Pansner. He basically decoded it and came up with my like top five variations, you know, mutations. And then from mm-hmm. that created this like program for me, which has been remarkable and really incredible. And some of the things he discovered was that I don't break down adrenaline well. I don't, I also don't receive vitamin, you know, sunlight well in my skin, more so just because I'm olive colored, but also more so mm-hmm. because of this mutation. And then right. I don't break the vitamin D down well and then absorb it well. So every process of the vitamin D making and absorbing breaking down process, I don't do well. It's a variant that I have, which explains a lot of stuff. But I was thinking, I think it was Dr. Mashgati I was talking to about why we would evolve to have such a mutation that would hinder my immune system. You know, is it to try to kill me off? And that's what I was thinking, like, is that, you know, but then your perspective triggered this thought now, which is, you know, maybe it was because, maybe it's because, and I'm an AB positive. So I think I find this in a lot of people who have AB positive, which I guess is the newest blood type, the most young blood type.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. The like most recent, you know what I mean, right? It's like the oldest is O, I think. Anyway.
Right.
And so that, you know, my body, my genetic profile is trying to adapt perhaps to all of these stressors, right? Like the 5G and the environmental toxin, the toxic break, those toxic load, everything. And maybe that vitamin D adaptation has something to do with, you know, who knows, like something we just don't understand yet. Same, you know, same with all of our variants with the MTHFRs and all the SNPs of that. And
right.
Like, you know, rather than thinking, oh, you know, our creator's just trying to, you know, okay, the what's it called? Natural selection.
Right. Knock us off. Right.
Right. Yeah. Maybe actually that's not the case. You know, maybe it's there's something happening here that is an adaptation to adapt to what's happening to the planet, you know?
Right.
Anyway, that's just a one-off.
No, I think that's a really good observation because I don't know of any animal or plant species on this planet, which is existing in the hopes of no longer existing further. Right. And from what I understand of evolution, I mean, I think that we're in a continual state of doing our best to adapt to our environment as the environment changes. Right. I mean,
except
that's really
panda bears.
Except panda bears.
Yeah, they'd only be alive if we kept them alive. There's no way they're safe. They have no function on this planet. They're the most useless. They're just full of cuteness, but they would never survive in the wild. Or a pug dog. How does that happen? Okay.
These are questions we might have to ponder at another time.
So that was the one-off question. My real question of wanting to keep you longer had to go back to the detoxification process of estrogen at the liver. Okay. So when I do a Dutch test, I see where the big issues start to show up at the liver at phase one, where we have the hydroxylation. And then we have phase two where we see the methylation. But when it comes to the 2OH, the 4OH, and the 16OH, when I see the pie chart, okay, they show it in a pie chart and it's like a balanced, you know, mostly you want to favor the 2OH. But then some people will favor the 16OH. And for those listeners who are new, the 16OH and the 4OH are pathways that we don't necessarily want our estrogen to travel down. It's going to travel down anyway, but we want more balance towards the 2OH. So there is a harmony with all of those pathways that we are hoping for in a healthy hormonal cycle for someone. So, people take DIM. I was told by my mentor that diendol methane helps convert the 16OH to the 2OH. That's all that it does. It doesn't help to convert it to 4OH. I mean, it doesn't help the 4OH. That's basically all that it does. There might be some benefit to the fact that it's from a crucifer. And so maybe there's some nutritional benefits to the DIM. I don't know. I'm making that up. But as far as its purpose in the detoxification process. Now, where in that process of phase one and phase two would DIM convert 16OH to 2OH? Is that
those are all really good questions. Okay. And you know, what I would do is I would take a step back to say that, and it's so interesting that you didn't realize this, Kitty, but you sort of began this well by talking about your genetics. I had someone tell me one time that in regard to DNA that our genetics, you know, loads the gun, but the environment pulls the trigger, Right. So we know that a lot of these genes are inducible, right? Which means that, based on the amount of a nutrient, in this case, let's say DIM or, maybe it might be resveratrol or curcumin, right? What happens is we have higher levels of these phytonutrients. What it does is it drives our liver to emphasize different pathways. So, the pathways that are involved in the hydroxylation are the cytochrome P450 system, right? And you've got cytochrome P450 1A1 and 1B1, right? And I can't remember right offhand which goes where. I want to say 1A1 goes to the 2-hydroxy and 1B1 goes to the 4 and the 16. But what that does is it takes estrogen, right, which is a fat soluble molecule, and it adds basically a water group. It's an oxygen and a hydrogen. That's a hydroxyl group in biochemistry, and that makes that water soluble, right? So what happens is the using of the DIM doesn't necessarily no. What it does is it influences what pathway the estrogen goes by, but it does it through inducing the cytochrome system within the hepatocytes, the liver cells. So basically, we know that the more cruciferous vegetables we eat, the more, what is it? Eat a rainbow, right? All the different colored vegetables, whether it's the luteins or the zeaxanthins, like all the different phytochemicals. I think there's some 5,000 that have been identified. The more of those that we consume, the more that the genetics in our liver are actually driven by these, right? So what happens is at that point, then you're left with this hydroxylated form of the hydroxyesterones, right? And these are the previous estrogen molecules now with a hydroxyl group on it. Okay. That's phase one detoxification. And then as you know, it needs to go through the phase two detoxification, right? And that's when you add another group onto this molecule that makes it even more complex. One of the most important groups that we add is the methyl group. Okay. So, when I look at something like a Dutch test or urinary metabolites, I think one of the most important things is not so much the 2,16 and 4 hydroxy residues, right? But it's are we able to methylate those? Because what happens is as we start to get a 2-methoxyestrone, 4-methoxyestrone, 16-methoxyestrone, that's almost kind of like safe haven when it comes to those molecules. And then once you get so the methylation is one of the steps that we, in phase two. And there's all kinds of other steps. There's sulfonation and glutathionation and there's all kinds of different molecules that get tagged onto this hydroxyestrone to do two things. One is it was to maintain its water solubility, so now it can get out in the urine, but most primarily it's excreted in the gut. But I read about something which is really interesting, which was described as a phase three detox. Okay, and the phase three detox, I think it was a Cambridge researcher who might have even coined the term. Okay, basically said that what happens is now we've got a hydroxyestrone that's now either a methoxyestrone or it's a glutathione estrone or it's something else that's it's conjugate. The thing is that now this has become a big polar and it's a large molecule. It can't get taken back up into the cells. So I heard someone start to talk about a phase three detox that I never heard about until just a few months ago. Because now you've got a molecule that's so big and so complex that it can't pass through the cellular membrane to get back into the cells. So there's almost a third component of this detoxification pathway,
But
which is
isn't
after you
that
go
the
through.
beta glucuronidation phase? Isn't that what
Yes,
phase three is?
it is, but I'd never heard
As a phase
it.
three.
I'd never heard that as a phase three, and as an actual physical. Now this molecule is too big to get back into our cells, and I thought that was what was interesting. So I would say phase two, phase
Cool.
three are basically the same, right? So it's the glucuronidation, the sulfuration, the methylation. I think there's a few other different pathways that are just kind of acetylation. These are different molecules that are added on to allow us to detox them. But so that's the main thing is it's, what we're doing
Interesting.
is by taking the DIM, taking the curcumin, taking
Sulforaphane.
the furfurane, the resveratrol, is what we're doing is those things are actually working on our DNA to emphasize different emphasis of the cytochrome P450, 1A1, 1B1 pathways. An example of how that works is, why is it that guys who are taking Viagra can't take grapefruit juice, right? They're familiar with
Right.
that, right? Because what
Yeah.
happens is the grapefruit juice, works to actually suppress the I think it's 3A4 pathway. So cytochrome P450 3A4, that helps to break down Viagra. Well, what happens is it doesn't break down, and these guys, for better or for worse, are being left with, eight-hour erections that might seem like it's a great thing in the first hour, but after that you realize it's becoming problematic. But so there's a really good example of even sort of like this confluence of modern medicine saying, look,
Yeah.
here's a pill, Viagra, that can actually help to maintain erections, which for a lot of men is really valuable, right? And partners for that matter. But what happens is if we take the phytonutrient, one of the chemicals that's found in grapefruit juice, that inhibits the metabolic pathways that breaks down Viagra, and these guys are left with really high levels of and I had one patient who was like, doc, this is great information. That means my Viagra capsule, I can just break it into quarters and I'll have a glass of grapefruit juice. And I was like, well, you got the concept right there. I don't know if I can.
That's a frugal guy.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's funny. Well, that also explains why DIM can make things much worse if it's not something you need. Now, how would DIM lower your healthy estrogen? Because I keep hearing this, and I feel like people are like, I took DIM and it lowered all my estrogen, and the Dutch references that as well. Be careful because you don't want to lower someone who's already got low,
Yeah.
estrone or whatever. But
I
I,
haven't seen that. So I can't answer that one.
okay.
I
Yeah,
haven't
it's
really thought about
interesting.
it in that context.
Well, if you come up with an answer, you let me know because I still don't understand why that is the case.
Yeah,
But
I'll be sure to see that. I'll be sure to look into it because I don't I from what I understand of the way that, the DIM is working, it's through inducing, it's increasing the activity of the cytochrome P450, 1A1, to help to drive this more down the more beneficial
yeah.
hydroxyestrogen pathways. And then you get into like how well is somebody methylating, and that's a whole additional story. Which you can tell through homocysteine, and I think methylmalonic acid is another good way of looking at it too.
Right. And the whole concept that overmethylation is just as bad as undermethylation, or can be
Right.
equally as much of a problem. Because I
Right.
see overmethylation a lot, and it's always the same personality types. It's always A-type personalities who are super competitive or overworkers, overachievers. Almost, is that so crazy? When I used to have clients on, like when I used to do phone consults, I could tell when I got on the phone with them after I had already looked at their stuff. When I got on the phone, I could tell. I would be like, if you just entertain me for a moment and indulge me and let me guess what you do for a living, or let me guess what you're. And I swear, out of every time I ever did that, I always hit the nail on the head. They were always, like either they're in charge at their office job, or they had, multiple, they were getting their PhD, and like they were always overworkers. They were athletic. They had a lifestyle of athleticism and competition. And it's so
Yeah.
interesting. I love that part
Right.
of it. Super
Yeah.
cool.
And then feed all that back into what we spent the first half of this talk discussing, which is what happens when you subject the body to high levels of cortisol, forever and forever.
Yeah.
People have, their memory isn't as good because their brain might be shrinking. Their gut is porous. It's like this, how about the woman who's like, I do all this working out, but I'm losing muscle mass. What's happening?
Yeah.
Oh, well,
Yeah.
that's cortisol is just doing what it's supposed to do. It's catabolizing your muscles. That's it's
Yeah.
the very first sentence in my biochemistry book is glucose's job, or I'm sorry, cortisol's job is to maintain the blood glucose at all cost, right?
Wow.
So,
That's so important. Well, on that note, maybe we'll call this episode
excellent.
that. This was so fun, and it's clear that we have to do another episode and come up with some more topics and just keep on
Oh,
having this fun
absolutely.
discussion.
Yeah, well, Kitty, it's so nice. And I love the fact that you and I kind of have like a little, like sort of like a secret appreciation of northern New Mexico. And where
Oh,
were you from?
yeah.
I want to say, was it Cimarron? I can't remember. Las Vegas. It was
I'm from Santa Fe, but my mom's family and my dad's family are all northern New Mexico in Mora. Do you know where Mora is?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, so that's where my mom and her mom and her mom were all from Mora. But we're like eight generation New Mexican. It's crazy.
That is crazy. And let me just say that it's we both understand just like the deep complexities of New Mexico in a way that you could tell people stories all day long, but until you've
Yeah.
lived there for a long period of time and really feel it, you don't understand like this crazy constellation of like it's probably one of the most real places I could ever imagine. I mean, there's
Yeah.
no artifice, right? I mean,
Yeah.
it's it's got incredible beauty. It's got darkness. It's got love. It's got spirituality. It's got, it's just
Yeah.
one of the most amazing places. But
It
well,
is
tell you
really
what,
special.
I would love to meet with you again and dive into some of these topics.
Okay.
You know how to get a hold of me, and I will continue to show up at your group and
Yes,
hopefully.
thank you for your contribution. You are much appreciated there. So thanks for your time.
I love it.
Such a great guest. Really thrilled to have him in our group and have him available to people to be able to ask questions in the group. He's awesome. He's very personable. And all of his information is in the show notes. You can reach out to him. He has a YouTube channel and a Facebook group and an IG, everything. And of course, fatigue2fantastic.com. He is launching that in August, which is today, August 1st. And it's a course that is unique in that it guides individuals to decrease fatigue and improve mood using self-assessment modules, basic science education, vetted lab studies, and curated supplementation. Ongoing weekly group meetings with him will provide community and ongoing support. Intake and outcome results will be demonstrated objectively through data collection and over time computer modeling and the AI technology he was talking about. The course, to include all testing, supplementation, and weekly meetings with the doctor, will be $4,000. Listeners from this podcast will have the course offered for only $2,000 and will have the privilege to be included as founders of the prototype course that in time will democratize medicine. How cool is that? So if you want to be part of this, you want to reach out to him. That information is in the show notes. And I will most likely join you in this cool prototype. And awesome. If you have any questions, just reach out to him. And also, just to remind you, Ona's is back in stock, and we are so grateful to everyone for their patience and understanding. Ona's is growing so fast, and it's wonderful, but we are having some growing pains that we are learning from quickly. So go to us.onasnatural.com.